This episode features depictions of violence, illness, medical malpractice, chemical poisoning, institutionalization, and suicide. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. Captain Hustwick hadn't slept in weeks. First, he had felt an itching on his skin. Then, his mouth grew dry. Shortly thereafter, he learned the dreadful news from Dr. J.A. Hawkins. Their ship, the Lady McNaughton, was infected with typhus. They docked at Sydney's quarantine station. The healthy passengers went ashore, but the sick stayed on board, including both Captain Hustwick and Dr. Hawkins. From his cabin, Hustwick watched nurses burn the bedding and clothes. A light knocking came at his door. With all the energy he could muster, he called for them to enter. It was Dr. Hawkins. Hustwick blinked in amazement. When he had seen the young doctor 2 days ago, the man could barely sit up. Now he was standing at his full height in the captain's doorway. But Hawkins' face was grim as he approached the captain. "Things were not getting better," he said. "Three more had died. The ship was rotten to the core." Hustwick forced himself to sit up. He insisted that things would improve, pointing out that the doctor looked healthier than ever. Dr. Hawkins shook his head sadly. A chill ran up Hustwick's spine. Flecks of something began falling from the doctor's head, as if his face was crumbling before Hustwick's eyes. Hawkins' pitiful expression withered, skin shrinking and tightening over his skull. Hawkins opened his mouth to speak, but no words came out. Hustwick could see down his gullet, and it was packed with a thick, cotton-like substance. Hustwick stood and went to his friend's side, but just as he reached him, the candle illuminating the room went out. In the dark, his hands closed over cold, empty air. The next morning, Hustwick received the news. Dr. Hawkins had died of typhus earlier that same night. Welcome to Haunted Places, a Parcast original. I'm Greg Polson. Every Thursday, I take you to the scariest, eeriest, most haunted, real places on Earth. You can find more episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Haunted Places for free on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Haunted in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. This week, join me on a supernatural journey to Sydney's North Head Quarantine Station, a facility established to prevent the spread of deadly diseases to the Australian mainland, and discover why, to this day, it's haunted. To enter Sydney Harbour by water, you have to pass a series of peninsulas known as the Sydney Heads. The first of these is North Head, a sheer face of sandstone cliffs near the suburb of Manly. In Australia's early years as a colony of the British Empire, North Head had a special significance. It was the first safe anchorage point for ships bound for Sydney. Because of this, in 1828, the Australian local government erected North Head Quarantine Station to serve as the first stopping point for emigrant ships. Its role as the first line of defense against the disease was cemented when New South Wales Governor Darling passed the Quarantine Act of 1832. This act set aside the whole of North Head as a quarantine zone for sick citizens and migrants alike. If you contracted a serious infection in New South Wales, you would be sent to the headlands to recover with those who had brought their infection with them from their home countries. Since Australia was founded as a penal colony, the country was no stranger to deadly diseases traveling from the British Isles to the Southern Hemisphere. Ships that had diseased passengers on board would raise a yellow flag and dock at North Head. In the early days of the station, they would leave their sick aboard, while the healthy passengers disembarked and were sheltered from the sickness. But after the arrival of the Lady Macnaghten in 1837, this process changed. Referred to in newspapers as the fever ship, the typhoid-ridden vessel lost 67 of the 444 people on board, including its doctor, to the disease. The heads of the facility realized if they were to have any success in treating illness, they needed facilities on dry land to treat infections. But many of the treatments in these state-of-the-art facilities were far from humane. Private Joseph Fitzroy had very little time to enjoy the end of the war. He heard the Allied forces were victorious over the Central Powers, but by the time that information reached him, he was too sick to care. On a medical transport halfway back to Sydney, a fever left him in constant discomfort, and his breathing felt labored and strangely wet, like his lungs had been soaked in oil. He wanted nothing more than to be in the company of his dear Rebecca, who he hadn't seen since he shipped out. But he knew well enough where his ship was headed. They would take him to the North Head quarantine station, where they could treat him for this awful flu. As they disembarked, Joseph pressed shoulder to shoulder with the other men, most in worn military uniforms. The sun beat down on his infected skin, causing him to squint. And then, the pleasant gloom of lamplight closed around them. They were all told to strip and follow the guards into the showers. Joseph was more than happy to comply. A hot shower is just what he needed after weeks of sweating on a poorly ventilated transport ship. He removed his ratty army uniform and tossed it onto the pile. He felt no sentimentality toward the thing. It had chafed and given him lice throughout the Gallipoli campaign. If he never saw it again, he would be a happy man. He then followed his guard's instructions into the shower. It was a small cubicle made of corrugated iron. Not exactly hospitable, but not the worst he could hope for. Below the shower head were two knobs, hot and cold. He had 2 minutes to rinse himself off. Joseph did not hesitate. He turned both knobs on to full blast and stepped into the stream. The shock of the heat passed quickly, giving way to relief. The warm water soothed his skin, making him feel fresh for the first time. But then, he started burning. The shower had become unbearably hot, scalding. Joseph shut off the hot valve and waited for the cold water to take over. It did, but not in the way he was hoping. As the temperature of the water cooled, his skin kept burning. The shower was now raining cold fire on him. He shut off the water at once. He felt like he was ablaze. Every movement caused a throbbing pain to course up his back, like he was sunburned all over. When he stepped out, trembling, into the hallway, he asked the guard if there was a bucket of cold water he could splash himself with. The guard laughed and told him to move on. The rough fabric of his hospital clothes cut burning hot grooves into his flesh. He spent the night writhing in agony on the hospital bed, going in and out of consciousness. In his dreams, he was back in Gallipoli, mortars and gunfire raining down on his trench. 2 nights later, Joseph's skin began to peel. He first noticed it on his shoulder as he shaved one night. The skin, still red and raw, had dried into a rough pink. It flaked like a fly molting. All night, he could not stop scratching at it. By the third night, the burning sensation was completely gone, replaced with a smothering numbness, his skin becoming rough and dry, like the parched ground of a desert. He scratched and scratched and scratched, hoping he would feel normal as soon as he removed every last inch of this ruined outer layer. He asked the nurse, a kind woman named Annie, what was going on. She told him his body was simply shedding the infection, and he would be right as rain in a few days. She dabbed his head with a damp cloth, which helped cool his temperature for a time. But still, he did not get better. In fact, no matter how hard he scratched at his burnt and ragged skin, he felt worse. That awful, wet feeling in his lungs grew, to the point where it felt like he was trying to breathe underwater. Something had to save him from this. Anything. Then he received word of a new treatment being tried out in a nearby building, a method of getting rid of the Spanish influenza entirely. They asked for volunteers, and he stood up immediately. He would do anything to get well, anything to see his beloved Rebecca again. They asked him if he had any experience with gases during the war, chlorine or mustard gas in particular. Joseph told them that he was familiar with them, but his unit had not been impacted by them. The nurse scribbled down his response and added him to the test. Joseph and a group of fellow patients were escorted into a barren room. At the far end was a pane of glass with a doctor behind it. He spoke to them calmly, telling them they would see a gas filtering into the room. They were instructed not to panic, simply breathe in. The gas would dry their lungs and cure their illness. They waited in the semi-darkness. A moment later, the gas seeped in. Taking the doctor's advice, Joseph closed his eyes and breathed deeply. His lungs exploded in agony. This was more than dry gas. It felt like tiny metal particles scraping the inside of his lungs. His insides burned. He found it impossible to focus, chanting to himself. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe. He grew lightheaded. He opened his eyes, squinting at the patients surrounding him. His fellow men were swallowed by the fumes until he was all alone in Gallipoli once again, smoke and cannon fire obscuring his vision. His comrades cried for help just out of sight, but they sounded leagues away. A single silhouette formed in front of him. It was his dear Rebecca. She wore black and a veil over her face. Though she didn't make a sound, he could tell she was weeping. He asked her why she was crying so, but she didn't respond. He reached out and touched her. Her veil flew up, revealing a horrible, sickly face, one that did not belong to Rebecca. It was his own face, weathered and aged into a husk of its former self. It looked like the life had been drained from his eyes. Then the gas cleared and Joseph Fitzroy was released, sputtering and coughing back into the medical ward. He didn't know what they had done to him, but he could not shake the sensation that this treatment had sealed his fate. The most infamous stories from Northhead Quarantine Station take place during the 1918 influenza pandemic. At the end of the First World War, the H1N1 virus spread across the globe, infecting and killing soldiers and civilians alike. No one knew where it started, and its death toll wound up being almost 50 million worldwide. It was dubbed the Spanish flu, since Spain, a neutral party during the war, was the first to publish any press coverage of the virus. The doctors and nurses of Northhead Quarantine Station worked night and day to handle the vast number of soldiers returning sick from the war. Though their efforts were in good faith, their methods caused an extreme amount of suffering among the patients. As soon as sick people were admitted, they would be escorted to the shower block. Though it did have hot and cold settings, The solution that poured from the shower heads was only about 5% water. The rest was carbolic acid, intended to kill bacteria and germs living on the skin. Without any other washing-up station, the sick would experience severe chemical burns as soon as they were admitted. As Spanish influenza ravaged the world, doctors attempted a radical treatment method in North Head Quarantine Station. Men suspected of infection were taken into a steam room, which was then filled with zinc sulfate gas, intended to dry out the lungs of those infected. Many years later, it was discovered that zinc sulfate may be a carcinogen. So, many of those treated with it may have developed cancer and died from this treatment. But soldiers returning from war weren't the only inhabitants of the station who died during this pandemic. The hospital staff was at great risk as well. A woman named Annie Egan was so moved by the suffering that she volunteered to serve as a nurse at North Head. Within 10 days of arriving, she contracted the disease. Realizing that she was going to die soon, she requested a Roman Catholic priest administer her last rites. However, the hospital staff refused to let any outsiders join her, as they could carry the disease back to Sydney. She died days later, her final wish unfulfilled. In the years since it closed down in 1984, visitors have seen a spectral woman in the hospital wing, moving from bed to bed, as if checking patients. This figure matches the pictures we have of Annie Egan, and she is far from the only ghostly inhabitant of the North Head Quarantine Station. In a moment, we'll meet some of the other spirits that live in the walls of the quarantine station. Now, back to the story. The importance of North Head Quarantine Station in protecting 19th century Australia from disease cannot be understated. Even a minor oversight could have had devastating consequences. A common tale from 1900 tells of a bookbinder named Robert William Smith, who received a package of books that needed fixing. This box had been transported on an infected ship, but the contents had not been decontaminated. When Smith opened one of the books, a flea leaped out from between the pages and bit him. He died 3 days later of bubonic plague. After 156 years of operation, North Head Quarantine Station was finally shut down on March 16, 1984. During this period, over 580 ships had stopped there due to sickness. Since its closure, it became part of Sydney Harbour National Park and was named a New South Wales National Heritage Site in April 1999. In addition to the preserved historical buildings, it now contains a hotel and a restaurant complex known as Q Station. But despite its new polished and tourist-friendly sheen, the North Head Quarantine Station contains a number of spirits who have refused to leave. Many of them are nameless apparitions, but at least one has a name and a tragic past he wants to impress upon visitors. Maya hated American businessmen. Not that she was in a position to do anything about it. She had to go where the money was. Working in the service industry was particularly unforgiving when she had to deal with entitled hedge fund managers who wanted to blow a ridiculous amount of money on a vacation in her home country. The sooner she didn't have to clean up after this kind of man, the happier she'd be. But here she was, watching as a dozen men who made more money this week than she did all year ate and drank their way through a four-course meal. It was a truly disgusting display. Every bit of crab or glob of salad dressing that struck the carpet made Maya wince internally. No matter how much they tipped, she still resented dealing with their revolting aftermath. She watched as the host, Daniel Eggers, drained a glass of expensive champagne, spilling half the contents down his front. She wondered how much of this display was poor manners and how much was his way of showing that he could afford to be this wasteful. She wondered if he suspected that they were eating their posh meal in what used to be the third-class dining area. That would infuriate him for sure. The meal was over before too long. Sufficiently inebriated, the men stumbled out of the dining room and into the night. Where were they headed? Out of the town? To the beach? Maya couldn't care less. As soon as they were off the premises, they were none of her concern. Cleaning the dining area was a predictably awful chore. She'd been hired for everything from bar mitzvahs to graduation parties, but none of those were anything like a mess made by rich men on holiday. Almost an hour after the men had left, she surveyed the fruits of her labor. 7 trash bags, full to bursting and ready for disposal. Once she disposed of them, she'd be free to go home. The first few trips out into the night were fairly uneventful. Pick up the bag, carry the bag outside, heave the bag in. It was a fairly simple order of operations, and it allowed Maya's mind to wander. She was picking up her 4th bag when she heard the sobbing. It sounded like a child in a great deal of pain. It was distant, but it echoed strangely, like a memory in an old movie. Maya's hands shook as she grabbed her next trash bag and made her way to the door. The crying grew louder with every step toward the quietly humming exit sign, as if daring her to turn around. When she gripped the handle and opened it, the crying ceased. Almost as if the fresh air from outside washed it away. Maya made her way quickly to the dumpster and threw the trash bag in. Then, she walked back toward the building in the darkness. She didn't need a flashlight. She had crossed up and down isolation roads so many times she could do it blindfolded. But she had never seen any children here before. Not of their own, anyways. A pair of light footsteps came up from the path. Or at least, that's what they sounded like. Once she stopped to listen closely, they dwindled into the sounds of waves striking the nearby cliffs. Maya picked up her pace, nervous feet carrying her back toward the dining area. The faint outlines of the foliage around her no longer looked like the welcoming tropical getaway that they had been mere moments before. They looked like rustling storm clouds waiting to strike. She slipped into the room once again and grabbed a bag in each hand. She wanted this to be over as soon as possible. She turned back toward the door and stopped halfway, mouth agape in shock. The garbage bag in her left hand split, spilling half-eaten seafood onto the floor, but she barely noticed it. Her vision was focused on the child crouched in the corner. The boy was huddled defensively, knees drawn up to his chest. His face was hidden behind his hands, and his shoulders shook with sobs. He couldn't have been more than 6 years old. Maya took a tentative step forward and looked the boy up and down. He was dressed in faded trousers and suspenders, like an urchin straight out of a Dickens novel. As she approached, she gasped. Every exposed inch of the boy's skin was covered in red spots. When he lowered his hands, Maya saw that the rash extended up to his face, where it coalesced into thick red patches beneath his eyes. But this did not make the child appear rosy-cheeked. Instead, he looked like he had been holding his breath for far too long, and all the blood had rushed to his head. Twin tracks of moisture ran down from his eyes across his parched skin. His gaze finally met Maya's. Then, he vanished between her blinks. Maya let out an involuntary gasp. The suddenness of the boy's disappearance made the hairs on the back of her neck stand up. But she was not relieved. Instead, she felt a strange tingling sensation squirming up her arms. For a moment, she thought a couple of ants had crawled from the trash bags and made their way up her limbs. But when she looked down, she screamed. Instead of insects, she saw a rash creeping up her arm. Red spot after red spot burst through her skin, and with each spot came an intense feeling of heat. She dropped her second bag and started to scratch at her blotchy skin, but the more she rubbed, the faster it spread. It worked its way up her arms, under her sleeves, and across her chest. The itching became unbearable. Her skin was squirming, crying, begging for some kind of relief from the sensation. She knew where she had to go for relief. The ocean was not too far south. She just had to follow Isolation Road. Breathing in and out, trying not to focus on her own agony, she stepped out of the dining room and followed the sound of the waves down the path. Her mind was almost blank from discomfort. More than anything, she wanted to rip her skin from her bones to stop it from itching. But she would not touch it. Scratching would only make the rash worse. She felt the heat of a fever pass across her forehead. Her immune system had failed completely. Finally, she reached the cliffs. In the gloom, she could make out the white surf churning by the beach. The moisture from the water touched her face, and it felt amazing, cooling. This was just the solution she needed. Carefully, she peeled off her uniform, exposing every inch of rash-ravaged flesh she possessed. The salt water would cleanse her of this strange infection. Maya took a deep breath and leaped from the cliff. The wind gliding across her skin felt divine. For a few precious moments, she was free from her job, her obligations to the rich, and that horrible, crawling infection on her skin. She hoped this feeling of calm would never end. Then, her fall stopped, and her relief lasted for an eternity. The history of class disparity is baked into the very foundations of North Head Quarantine Station. The doctors did not only divide healthy and unhealthy at North Head, but rich and poor. But diseases like typhus and influenza did not make any such distinctions. Wealthy and impoverished families alike were torn apart as the doctors strived to keep diseases from spreading. This often had devastating effects on young, poor children, who were uncommonly susceptible to diseases. In recent years, many visitors and employees at Q Station have noticed a particular spirit lingering in the third-class dining area. It manifests as a young boy sitting in the corner, weeping. As they approach him, he mysteriously vanishes into thin air. This boy, Isaac Lowe's, was one of many poor children torn away from their families for quarantine, never to see their parents again. Lowe's contracted scarlet fever and died on August 25th, 1878. He was only 6 years old. Isaac Lowe's is far from the only child who has been seen haunting Q Station. A girl of around the same age, named Marianne, is known to follow tour groups around, playfully opening and closing doors, or holding guests' hands. She's a favorite among ghost tour guides, for she seems to enjoy interacting with the guests, and only wishes to play rather than disturb. However, some of the childlike spirits in Q Station are far less pleasant to spend time with than Marianne. In a moment, we'll meet one of the North Head Quarantine Station's most infamous and unsettling spirits. Now, back to the story. It's no secret that North Head Quarantine Station is among the most haunted locations in all of Australia. But perhaps one of the most disturbing things about these hauntings is just how enigmatic many of them are. Records surrounding the quarantine station are sparse, particularly in the earlier parts of its history, So discerning the identities of these ghosts is an exceedingly difficult task. Spectral figures have shown up in countless photographs taken in North Head, and most of these spirits remain unidentified. This has included a tall man with a disfigured face, a mortician nicknamed Mr. Slimy by the staff, a woman in a blood-soaked white gown, a friendly Chinese fisherman, and the ever-present ghost of devout nurse, Annie Egan. But more so than all these other ghosts, a particular figure enjoys tormenting the guests of Q Station. She's been spotted all over the grounds, but is most commonly seen near the dumbwaiter. She is the only ghost known to leave scars on those she encounters. The vacation was supposed to help them heal, help Lena forget about what had happened. But she knew before they left that it wouldn't do them any good. Losing a child isn't something you can take a vacation from. To make matters worse, Lena had contracted a cold on the way here, so she spent much of the trip sneezing and shivering, in spite of the winter heat. She corrected herself. It was summer here, not winter. But even as the thought crossed her mind, she felt guilty. For a moment, she had let her daughter slip from her mind. She could not do that. It was the only thing keeping the girl alive. She imagined what it would be like taking this tour with her little girl, her little Anya. As they approached the cluster of old buildings, Lena gave Peter a reassuring but empty smile. They piled out and ventured inward. The sun dipped low in the horizon, casting a golden hue over the cliffside. This must be the last tour of the day, Lena mused. The tour passed in a blur. Lena tried her best to humor her husband, but the spooky corridors that once would have delighted her just weren't enough to pierce her veil of grief. For much of the tour, she was almost sleepwalking, nodding absentmindedly, and letting herself be guided from building to building. She came to as they stood in front of an enormous teal door. It looked like a bank vault, but she was told it was a disinfectant station, a place where luggage would be loaded in and cleaned. While looking into the cavernous doors, small fingers brushed her hand. It felt like a child's hand. Lena looked down and saw nothing. A gust of chill air stirred her bangs. With the breeze, she heard a voice whispering into her left ear. "Follow me," it said. It sounded like a girl. It sounded like... Lena whipped her gaze to the left in the direction of the strange voice. Her eyes caught a flash of pink vanishing around the corner. Her heart stopped. Anya had worn a pink dress on her last birthday. No longer heeding the tour guide's droning lecture, Lena followed the child she had glimpsed. She was not hearing these things. She was perfectly sane. The spirit was calling to her, and no one else. The light outside dwindled, casting the rooms into a gloomy gray pallor. Every time she rounded a corner, she spied just the briefest hint of pink in the distance, barely enough to keep her from making a wrong turn. It led her into a room that contained rows and rows of metal stalls. The darkness yawned at her from the end of the corridor, and at the very edge of her vision was that same glimmer of pink. The harsh scream of metal door hinges came from up ahead. Her little girl was getting away from her. Stifling a cough, Lena ran. Her footsteps echoed around her, multiplying until they were the sounds of 1,000 men and women pushing and shoving their way through the cramped confines of the station. Wheezing and coughing echoed off the walls. And then, the voices were silent. She burst through a metal door and back into the open air. It was almost completely dark now, and the sky above her was a deep blue, only a shade or two away from black. Her eyes strained to discern any details in the world around her. A pang of loneliness hit her heart when she failed to see even the slightest spot of pink. She had lost Anya again. And then, little cold fingers closed over her own. They pulled once, twice, three times. Finally, Lena let them guide her away. She could not see where they were going, but she did not care. Her girl was with her again. Tears of joy rolled down Lena's cheeks, even as the walls of the quarantine station closed back around the pair of them. She knew her daughter was dead, but that didn't matter, as long as her spirit could find peace. The dull orange glow of the light fixtures came back into sight. Lena still could not see the tour group, but she could hear the voices floating on the air towards them. She grinned. She had to tell Peter. He had been right all along. The vacation had given her closure. Finally, they could put this tragedy behind them. She looked down at the girl by her side in the dull light. She was about to ask if she could take her back to her father, when the words caught in her throat. The figure holding her hand was not Anya. It was a little girl in a pink dress, but her hair was white and patchy. Her eyes, once vibrant, had a milky film over them that made them appear hollow and lifeless. But worst of all were the cracks that ran along her veins, dark fissures that wound their way up and down her arms, squirming as if filled with some black viscous fluid. The girl looked up at Lena and grinned. Her teeth were black as well and worn down to stumps. Lena tried to pull her hand away, but this little girl held on, her fingers tightening like a vise. Lena opened her mouth to scream, and that's when the creature pounced. The thing reached up, grabbing onto Lena's forearm. Before she had a chance to pull away, it began to climb. It weighed almost nothing, but its fingernails stung as they dug into Lena's arm. Hand over hand, this horrible mockery of a girl pulled itself up to her throat. Its fingers closed around her windpipe, and the two of them toppled to the floor, one on top of the other. Lena tried to cry for help, but the creature's awful lifeless thumbs only pressed down harder, choking off her air. The creature cackled at Lena, a dry, breathy sound. Lena felt her strength leaving her. The dim orange glow of the room flickered, and the darkness seemed so inviting. Soon, she would be able to rest, to join her Anya. She closed her eyes and let her hands fall to her side. The sound of a door opening forced life back into Lena's limbs. The girl's hands withdrew from her neck. When the room came into focus, she was alone. The pink dress was nowhere to be seen. A moment later, her tour group surrounded her, Peter ahead of everyone else. He knelt down by her and took her in his arms, asking what had happened. She wept openly, unable to form words for the longest time. Their girl wasn't coming back. Many visitors and employees have felt strange presences throughout the North Head quarantine station. Sudden gusts of cold air and voices whispering are frequent occurrences, but the most malevolent of these occurrences seems to be a spirit that no one on site has a name for. A number of guests have seen a girl in a pink dress who flits from building to building. She's been known to take guests' hands and lead them throughout the facility, but on certain occasions, she has taken her interactions to a whole different level. Sometimes she'll grab at a guest's ankles or hands violently, trying to pull them off balance. And on at least one occasion, she attempted to throttle one of the visitors. This ghostly attack left red marks on the woman's throat, and the rest of the party was permanently shaken. Who is this girl? One of the countless children who were separated from their families due to disease? Or is she simply an evil spirit who takes a seemingly innocent form in order to approach her victims. We may never know for sure, as she has no interest in communicating. Like many landmarks in Australia, North Head Quarantine Station is both a monument to the history of the colonies and a grave for the countless individuals who suffered and died within its walls. Due to the vague historical records, no comprehensive death toll of North Head was ever assembled. The closest thing we have is a series of etchings carved around the facility by the former inmates. The sandstone formations around North Head are covered in carvings dating back to the 1830s. There are over 1,000 inscriptions written on the cliffs around the jetty, as well as the rock formation known as Old Man's Hat. All of them were written by infected persons passing through this facility, many of whom did not survive their journey. There are poems, journals, notes, and sometimes warnings. One of the most infamous carvings is written in Chinese. Translated, it says, "I do not recommend coming here for pleasure." The inscriptions are written in all sorts of European, Arabic, and Asian languages. Most of the non-English testimonials have yet to be translated. In 1983 and 1999, various Australian historical societies conducted preliminary analyses of these carvings. Their findings stated, "The inscriptions are valuable and unusual graphic illustrations of historical incidents and social patterns of quarantine station history. They provide a very tangible and human link with the past for present generations, and are a valuable historical and genealogical resource. Their research potential is enormous. The inscriptions record a variety of information which cannot be obtained from any other source, especially the feelings of non-English-speaking migrants." Even though authors and researchers have been cataloging these carvings in recent years, hundreds of them were lost to time. A shroud of mystery will always remain over the North Head Quarantine Station, no matter how thoroughly it has been explored. So, if you're planning on visiting Sydney Harbor, be sure to check out North Head Quarantine Station. Maybe read some of the testimonials left on the sandstone cliffs. But don't make the journey if you're feeling unwell. If you're not careful, you may never leave. Thanks again for tuning into Haunted Places. We'll be back on Thursday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Haunted Places, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Haunted Places on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Haunted Places in the search bar. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoyed the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Haunted Places was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Kenny Hobbs. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Haunted Places was written by Robert Teamstra. I'm Greg Polson.